it's funny the way in which, you know, he just survives everything and just keeps going. So my money is on the fact that if they do make more, they will still be literal cliffhangers. And what I envision is Tom Cruise will be dangling from a cliff, and dangling from his ankle will be Harrison Ford. And so these aging action heroes will just keep going.
Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we're going to talk about the new and final Mission Impossible Final Reckoning and a movie called Secret Mall Apartment, starting with the big blockbuster movie. Mike, have you seen all of the gazillion Mission Impossibles, including the TV show?
Yes, of course. I've done nothing else with my time for almost 30 years. And so, yes, I've kept up with it. But I had to smile when it was announced that this would be the final one, because, you know, with franchise filmmaking, never say never as to when something is really final. And what's really curious, and I can't fully answer this, is that, you know, Tom Cruise, as we speak right now, is about to turn 63. So he's certainly a veteran of this franchise and others. And the most recent entry in the Mission Impossible series had been titled Dead Reckoning Part 1, came out in 2023. One would think logically that the movie we're talking about right now would be considered Part 2. but no, the title of it is Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning. So somewhere in the marketing, they decided to reinforce not just that this is a sequel to a sequel to a sequel to a sequel, but that this is the final one. So who knows if that will be the case, because, you know, reviewers have had fun with this, that, you know, the Tom Cruise character, Ethan Hunt, seems to have near mythic proportions. And it's funny the way in which, you know, he just survives everything and just keeps going. So my money is on the fact that if they do make more, they will still be literal cliffhangers. And what I envision is Tom Cruise will be dangling from a cliff. And dangling from his ankle will be Harrison Ford. And so these aging action heroes will just keep going. So let me hand it back to you. I have a lot to say about the film, but I don't want to exceed its running time, which for the record is 169 minutes. It's a rather hefty running time, a lot of escapades here. So let's take about 168 minutes at least to talk about it. Back to you.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the runtime, because, you know, we always talk about the runtime. If it goes over, did it really have to go over? Part of that is because they had to do so much exposition to bring everybody up to speed on what happened in all the previous Mission Impossible. So, which I did not mind, because I, you know, was kind of lost with some of the characters, quite frankly. I sort of appreciated it. But the runtime just makes you think, Mike, it's part two and the final. They just made, you know, put two movies together. That's why it's so long.
Well, we had a similar discussion actually when Wicked, when the part one came out, and you know, had a, you know, running time of like 2 hours and 45 minutes, whatever, which is the exact running time of the Broadway show. And then, you know, this fall we'll have part two for that one, which, you know, goodness knows. I mean, I know about, you know, milking a franchise and going to the box office as often as you can, but it goes beyond shameless. It's into like the surreal realm at some point. How much can we stretch this? And honestly, I got to say that this film, you know, has so much hyperactive, you know, escapades. It has so much going on that it's never exactly boring, but it certainly is formulaic at this point. You know, at a certain point, okay, we're going to be in a car, and then we've got to be in an airplane, preferably like a World War I vintage airplane. you know, it's a little bit of Indy Jones at a certain point. Mm-hmm. We need to do all of that. But again, it just seems to me so excessive. I know that the formula seems to be that more is better, but you know, as you and I have said quite often, maybe a little bit less would be better, particularly here, because there's really nothing new to establish. And let me get to the heart of the matter, as in why I find the film disappointing in various ways. Yes, the excessive running time, the kind of shameless milking of that, but also the story itself. Now, part one was telling us all about something called the Entity. And it's some sort of AI that, in the usual formula, is going for total worldwide domination and/or destruction. Why? Well, that's what it does, right? You know, we're going to take over the world in order to destroy it. Well, gee, what's the reasoning there? And so, anyway, I can't quite parse that out. The film itself barely bothers. I mean, what happens is, as Tom Cruise's character and some of the others try to explain this and to the audience as much as to themselves, I noticed at the level of, I sound like a dramaturg or drama director here, but at the level of line readings, there's a lot of space between words. Two characters will square off and they are going to tell us about something important. And as they do that, I think, well, real people typically don't talk quite that way. They don't all talk as fast as I do, but they don't typically talk that way. And that's where you have that sort of really like overly deliberate exposition. But ironically, it explains nothing, or it's just mumbo jumbo. And I can only take a certain amount of mumbo jumbo. And it, like if it were a fleet 100 minutes, I'd say, fine, it's entertaining. You know, you finish your popcorn. But here you have to go back for like a second box of popcorn. It really pushes things that way. And this actually dovetails back with something you alluded to earlier, that some of the secondary characters here, played by capable actors like Ving Rhames and Simon Pegg and so on, and Haley Atwell, they really seem like ancillary in such a way that when they disappear for more than 5 or 10 minutes at a time and they come back, it's like, oh yeah, right, that's who this is or that is. There doesn't seem to be much of what I call meaningful connection. It just seems to me that they pop in as the screenplay page has them pop in again. How do you feel about that? Because to me, one of the flaws of the film is that I'm not expecting, you know, depth psychology, but it just seems really shallow in so many ways. It's just simply going from stunt to stunt and character to character in that regard. What do you think?
I completely agree. And I was laughing when you were talking about how slowly they said important things, like in the blink of an eye, then a pause, and then the other person looking at them nodding slowly, in the blink of an eye. I mean, some of that could really have been edited.
You know what? Since we talk a lot about editing on a show like this one, trying to keep ourselves tight, if you simply like took out some of those pauses, you could cut like 20 minutes from the film. You know, it really would be an action picture then. Ironically, again, it's an action picture that really does slow down during the expository scenes.
Also, you know, Tom Cruise is known for doing his stunts. And, you know, that is truly impressive, I have to say. It is impressive what he has done in all of these Mission Impossible movies. But I feel like I saw an interview with Steven Spielberg where he talked about making Jaws and how you could only make the shark look real for like, I can't remember, it's like 44 frames, but not 45. You know, that extra frame made it look fake. And but he just wanted, you know, they took so much time and so much setup. They just really wanted to use it as much as they could. And I feel like that whole plane chase thing, they had so much great footage. They just couldn't bear to cut any of it. But I think it would have been tighter and more interesting if they had.
That sequence in particular, if you watch it for like just 2 minutes here, 3 minutes there, it's really exciting. I mean, it's really bravura on a technical level. But again, it's that kind of technical overkill, like how much can you take? And then, you know, you realize that a venture like this is essentially implausible, right? So much of it would be, you know, on all sorts of the laws of physics, if you will. And I know it's sort of like a stick in the mud observation, but the fact that even that kind of pushes the limits of like, oh, come on, give me a break now. He's dangling from this wing of the plane, then that one. He still manages to get up there and punch out the guy. There's always like, it always ends up like a fist fight. For all the high tech stuff, it's a fist fight. One guy's going to punch another guy in the face. We're still mano a mano that way. But if I can state my numerous objections to the film or, you know, things I don't really care for in it, I got to say the film itself does take itself so seriously, as in this is not just part two, it's the finale, and, you know, finale itself, you want a trumpet flourish at that point, it's the finale. But the fact that the film itself has what I call a highlight reel sensibility to it with its use of flashbacks. At several points in the film, it gives you tightly edited montages of, you know, things that this character Ethan's done before. And yes, I recognize the footage, and I guess it's nostalgic in a way that I welcome. But it seems rather self-congratulatory, doesn't it? The fact that the film is so proud of its status all these decades later. And, you know, here's an action hero in his 60s, and he still looks great, and he's still able to do it. But that's a lot of back padding, isn't it? It seems to me that's where the filmmakers... Because the director of this film, Christopher McQuarrie, this is the fourth one he's directed. So for not just Tom Cruise, but for the director and all, this is their lunch. This is what they do. You know, these guys do this very well on a technical level. But I just it seems to me that, you know, the ego is kind of out of control here. And that's an interesting question, because Tom Cruise, you know, does have this kind of modest persona, but I'll put quotation marks around modest there. But back to your earlier point, he does have reason to be proud here that he has been one of the true and genuine and maybe only movie stars that we have. I mean, you know, all due credit to that. He is a genuine movie star. He does not have great range as an actor, but he knows his limits. You would never want to see him as Hamlet. He would never want to see himself as Hamlet. He's not going to try any sort of Mel Gibson occasional moves elsewhere. He knows his range is limited, but boy, he's really exceptional within that range. And you know, it's the Top Gun kind of persona, which is related to this. And he's just like, you know, movie star handsome. How can he not be? And even though he's looking a little weathered now, if you'd gone through all these adventures over 30 some years, you'd look a little weathered. And it seems to me that at this point, Tom Cruise, you know, has that iconic status and mostly seems to wear it lightly. But then in a film like this one, as you and I have been saying, with the highlight reel sensibility and the slow line readings, there is a ponderous quality. And a film like this, which is essentially silly, should just be silly and it not quite as great a length, you know? It just let it move along there, but not to always be patting itself on the back. And this is where I think the actor's ego, or just the filmmaker's ego, if you will, they know they're a major franchise, and they keep reminding us of that. And I know that history. I've squandered many hours of my life watching the franchise. I don't need those constant reminders during the finale. How about you, having also spent many hours watching the franchise?
Well, you know, the thing that they always include, which I think is essential, is this tape will self-destruct. You know, after you listen to the message, that's the most Mission Impossible part of it. But you know what? It reminded me more of Get Smart in some ways, because, you know, Ethan would be, you know, trying to get through the submarine, and there'd be like a porthole he had to go through. And then after that, there would be, you know, some weird kind of door on the floor. And then after that, you know, you have to swim up to this other thing and go through that door and then this door. There was just a lot of making his way through a submarine that was at the bottom of the sea, but somehow still hadn't filled up completely with water. I mean, so many things, you really had to suspend disbelief because it was silly, like you said. Dumb, but fun. That's how we sort of summed it up afterwards.
Well, it's a tricky thing in a creative sense, because the film is, I mean, it's beyond borderline implausible, but it's beyond borderline silly at times. But the kind of emotional balance to strike, and to its credit, you know, when you have the cliffhanger sequences and the threats coming from here and there, a lot of that is done at a level where you can put aside reservations and you know, logic and all that, and sort of take it straight, right? There are times you can watch that and really get pulled into it. There are other times where even the characters themselves realize how silly it is. And, the usual proverbial wisecrack. You've almost been killed in some ridiculous stunt thing, and then you make a little joke, right? And that's a tricky thing to pull off. And I've got to say, to the credit of the film, often enough, it does manage to, like, make you smile at times at just how ridiculous it is, but essentially keep you with it. Because if it went too far in the direction you're indicating, it would become like Get Smart. And there were places where I had to smile because it's so self-referential. You're right. The tape that's going to, you know, self-destruct in 5 seconds. And those are sequences where they really do have it self-destruct in 5 seconds. It's not like it's not drawn out to 25 seconds. It goes quickly there. And then, of course, in terms of the Lalo Schifrin theme music, the film is sparing with its use of that. And then it really comes charging in at the very end, which is how it should be, actually, because if indeed it's the final installment in the series, you do want to hear that as the movie goes out. So again, the film opened, as you and I are talking, the film just recently opened. It opened well. I mean, there's still definitely an audience for this, but I'm just thinking maybe if we take it at its word that it's the finale, maybe Cruise himself is thinking that, you know, he's into his 60s now and he can do all sorts of other things. There are other franchises he has that he can revisit, Top Gun, whatever, that doesn't have to go on. Now, this is looking into the crystal ball, but because the film opened well and presumably will end up doing well, you know, a year or so from now, it's so easy to sit down at the conference table and say, hey, guys, let's go once again. You know what? We thought we had killed off the entity, but it's hard to get rid of AI. Like, it's still up there in the cloud somewhere. It's back. And we got to call you out of retirement to fight this thing again. And you and I are smiling right now, but it's no laughing matter. They might well, you know, come back in another year or two with another one. And, you know, again, And that's why I mentioned Harrison Ford earlier, because there are franchises where you think, geez, haven't you had enough already? And no, indeed, you haven't. I mean, you know, as you and I are talking right now, and we're looking into the summer movie schedule, you have things like, you know, Jurassic World and so on. You have these franchises that just keep chugging along. They're multi-generational at this point. You can say, oh, when I was a kid, I saw the first one. Now I take my kids to go see it. And I guess that's heartwarming in a way. But creatively, you realize that, you know, Hollywood blockbusters just oftentimes tend to hit the same few buttons. And if it pays off at the box office, who can blame them in a fiscal sense?
You know, I have to hand it to Hayley Atwell, because I understand she was 8 months pregnant doing this film. And I went into the movie knowing that, and I was looking for it. And they did a really good job of hiding it. I mean, mostly they just show her face, you know, in most of the scenes. But, you know, that's a lot of intense action.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, with the length of the film, I thought she would give birth in the final 20 minutes. So. This is the longest pregnancy on record, Marie.
It's true. It's true. You know, what's going to happen with the next movie is not only will the AI have backed itself up to the cloud somehow, but the stunts will be AI now so that they can be even more ridiculous.
Well, you know, this is again, people make jokes, and I do too, certainly as a person, about Tom Cruise doing his own stunts, right? And you know, it's easy to make jokes about that, but he does. I mean, he really has put himself through a lot of this. I mean, that, and in the highlight reel segments, you know, he's dangling from skyscrapers and he would do things like that. So that's really immensely to his credit. And so, you know, I got to give props there. But again, when you mentioned Atwell and some of the other actors, and I did earlier too, some of them just sort of pop in and out and they don't really get a chance to flex. These are capable actors, but they just sort of do what they're called on to do. And I think the worst case here would be, you know, an actress as talented as Angela Bassett. She plays the U.S. president here. If we had ever elected a Black woman as president, here she is. And so here she is as the president. You know what? She has some of the worst line readings because she has to say really ponderous things with a lot of space between the words. And she does have a great face. I mean, she's got this really incredibly photogenic face. So she squares off. And it's enough just to look at the face, but then you count to 10 between words and she makes some pronouncement. But you know, she, as a character, she has like almost no character. I mean, it's essentially just she's the position. She's the president and she's got to make a tough decision about, you know, do I hit this button or that one in terms of ending the world? And so you feel bad. And this is where I, you know, all joking aside, feel what a shame in some ways. You get really capable actors like this. You think of the movies they could be making. And they're making this one. So put it at that level of like talent and how best to use your talent. She's done terrific work before, but what happens is when you become a name, how can you say no to the big paychecks? Mm-hmm. And it's relatively easy to do and probably enjoyable to do it. But you realize that it's essentially what a writer would call a left-hand exercise, you know, for the actor to do something like that. You don't have to dip too deeply into your reservoir of talent to do it. And that's where I watch it thinking, what a shame. I mean, all this talent that is not exactly squandered, but not fully realized either.
There was a nice scene with Angela Bassett and her son. Very short scene near the end.
That was
heartwarming. I do want to mention that to people who haven't seen this movie, there is no Easter egg at the end. So you don't have to sit through all the credits. You can go make a break for the bathroom after waiting from us 3.5 hours, however long.
That is the best consumer advice. Because I mean, I always sit through the end credits, but like I was looking for a scene at the end, like you thought it was the finale. Oh no, I didn't want to miss that. But no, really. So unless you want to read all the special effects credits, you don't need to sit through all that at the very end of the film. So that's the best thing to know about the film, actually. Which all things considered, it was not exactly a time waster. I mean, it was worth seeing. It was, you know, marginally, I call it marginally exciting at times. And
it was fun to watch. You know, I mean, it delivered what it promised. But it didn't.
Yeah, it doesn't promise. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't over deliver. That's true. I mean, if it under delivers, at least it's in an expected way, you know. and you and I see truly dreadful movies all the time. So believe me, it's good mass entertainment. So it's hard to say that without sounding condescending, but it is. It's good mass entertainment.
It is. Really, it's a popcorn movie. All right. So let's move on to Secret Mall Apartment. And, you know, Mike, I think I saw this at Maryland Film Festival, but you didn't go with me because you had something you had to do. So I got to see this when it first came out.
Au contraire. Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite, actually. This is a really small and quirky documentary film, the sort I like. And the au contraire is that I saw this film at the Maryland Film Festival on May 5th, 2024. So, you know, I saw, and the reason I was going to mention that in any event was that sometimes documentaries like this, really low budget and you know, idiosyncratic, they can take a time or take a while to find an audience, and then as to how people find the film. So you and I then had seen it at the Maryland Film Festival back in as we used, you and I speak right now, this is like more than a year later. So, you know, we saw this May 5th, 2024. And then in terms of the film at the very local level, finding an audience beyond that film festival in Baltimore City, just now as we speak, it finally is playing a regular commercial run at the Charles Theater, which is just a block away from the Parkway where the Maryland Film Festival is. So I've been thinking about that. But here we saw it like more than a year ago at the Parkway. And now like that year later, a year and some days later, yes, it does have a regular run at the theater down the street. And I'm thinking, well, this is how films like this do get out. Providentially, in some ways, a film like this is going to have a sort of cult following. So why not have a cult release pattern where some people see it at a film? You know what I mean? Some people, you see it at a film festival or a late night screening, or it slips into a theater for a week or so. That actually, ironically, can sort of play to advantage. That it's just like, oh, yeah, I saw it early and I saw it here or there. And, oh, really? Where'd you find it? You know, that kind of a thing. Now, the one reason I like this film, when I mentioned it being quirky and idiosyncratic, is you can't go wrong with this as realistic material, because this is something that happened back in 2003. Okay, so eight people in Rhode Island has a small population, so I guess eight is like a considerable percentage of the population, but eight Rhode Islanders in 2003, they went to the Providence Place Mall. They went to their mall, and they decided to set up a secret apartment, you know, hidden within the innards of the mall. And it's a quirky idea, because when we think about malls as gathering places where many people, you know, spend or have spent many hours, and we think about how the mall itself supports what I'll call a lifestyle. You go there to buy, you know, furniture and clothing, whatever else, and then take it to your house. Why not have your house not only near the mall, but inside the mall? And of course, surreptitiously, because the security guards wouldn't think kindly of this. And so what makes the film interesting is in large part that premise. They're going to set up a 750 square foot apartment hidden within the innards of the mall. And then secondly, and related to that, what makes it so interesting is what I call the procedural quality here. Once you have that as your setup, or they have that as their setup, how do you go about it? How do you sneak in and out? Where do you get your furnishings? You know, you want to have a sofa, you want to have this and that. And how do you actually live there? Which they did for 4 years. So it's really quite interesting at that level. And the director, Jeremy Workman, you know, as with so many small documentaries, he's so devoted to a subject, he stays with it. You know, he's like that level of trust of like hanging out with the people that you're documenting, and that kind of up close look. So this is a case where, and it's a great contrast with the Mission Impossible movie we were just talking about, because that movie takes full advantage of its big budget and its long running time and the extravaganza of special effects and all this and movie stars and et cetera, et cetera. This movie is the exact opposite. It's a tiny budget. It's just this offbeat subject. And it would actually hurt the movie, I think, if it had a bigger budget and more resources. You want to feel like you know, that sort of fly in the wall feeling, that just somehow you're there inside the room. And if the lighting is less than ideal, that's okay, because it was less than ideal. If people stumble as they speak, well, at least they speak more quickly than the characters in Mission Impossible. So I like those qualities there. And I was really intrigued by that. And the fact that a movie like this is, when I say open-ended, I mean open. And then in the sense of, we can all have our interpretations, our theories as to why these people would do this. And they talk about it themselves, but we're looking in, wondering about this. And you kind of project yourself into that room, if you will, into that apartment, like, gee, you know, I've never thought about this. I haven't done it and contemplated it. But why would they do it? And open-ended in the sense that it sparks discussions like the one we're having right now. So back to you.
Well, I have to say, they had me at Secret Mall Apartment, because that just sounds so intriguing. You know, it sounds like the idea you had as a kid, how cool it would be to be trapped in the mall after, you know, after everything was closed, because, you know, there's beds you can sleep on, there's a food court, there's restrooms, there's everything you need. What I found interesting about it is that all of these people involved were artists. There was a professor from Rhode Island School of Design, and then his wife and some students, but eight people all in all. And they had been using this old these old warehouses to do their art. And they got kicked out so that, you know, they could mow everything down to make parking and make room for this mall. So I like the sort of rebelliousness of, well, we're just going to find a little hidey hole, and we're going to make that art. It's going to be sort of, sticking it to the man. And because they had to build it around a river and some train tracks and existing highways, it had, you know, not a lot of squares. It had a lot of triangles and weird shapes. So they kind of sussed it out and thought, there's got to be a dead space there. If we could just find our way to that space, you know, what would it be like? And it kind of mushroomed into this interesting project. But, you know, you could never do this today because, you know, there's so much surveillance now. You know, they'd find you within 10 minutes. But this is, you know, 2003. I mean, even the quality of the video cameras they're using is just so much less than today. So it's kind of it had to happen when it happened, but I don't know that it could happen now. But it's a very intriguing idea. And the other thing is that when they're not doing this thing with this apartment, they're doing this because they're all artists. They're doing this really cool art with masking tape at hospitals and public buildings. And they do an installation in New York City to honor the first responders from 9/11. And so it's really about the lives of these artists, too, doing this really covert thing. And the sneakiness is the best part. You know, just the fact that they got an armoire up a really skinny ladder. Just the watching them, you know, squeeze through these narrow spaces, you think, you know, could I do that? Could you do that, Mike?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned it as and yes, of course, I'm like Tom Cruise. I could do that. Yes, no problem. but no, I'm glad you mentioned the art project aspect of it, because and artists affiliated with Rhode Island School of Design, RISD, because so many contemporary artists are thinking about art projects that directly interface or interact with the actual environment around them. Sometimes with an overt political or ecological message, et cetera, but oftentimes just simply to get out of the gallery and into other spaces and to, you know, yet again question, you know, the definition of art and the placement of it and so on. So it's not at all unusual that you know, artists would think and operate that way. What is a bit unusual is the extremity of what they do. I mean, very few would, you know, do something as bold as what we're talking about, and for that duration of time. I mean, they really put themselves into that. And so this is why I think the film, I mean, it's worth, if you like documentary films, it's definitely worth seeing. If you like shopping malls, it's worth seeing. And I would think too that anyone who's an artist or an art student or just has an interest in contemporary art would want to think about it also at that kind of conceptual level in terms of what we call art. So it fires on all cylinders there. It's really registering on at least a few levels. One reason why I called it open-ended was that very rationale that you can approach it in all the ways you and I are indicating right now, and probably more beyond that. It really opens up the discussion rather than closing it down.
I would recommend this. I would also say I'm impressed that eight people could keep a secret for 4 years. I think that's very impressive. But I also like the underlying message, which is, you know, you can do art. Everybody can do art. It's all around you. It's, you know, putting yourself into whatever that you're creating. Hopefully you find a bunch of people you have this much in common with.
And hopefully you don't get arrested as you're doing your art.
Yeah, that would be a plus. Yes, let's not get arrested while doing our art. Well, that does bring us to the end of this episode. But don't forget to check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Thank you for listening to Dragon Podcast. You can find this episode and all other Howard Community College podcasts available for your listening pleasure on all streaming platforms, as well as Podbean at podbean.com/dragonpodcast. Thank you for listening.